Blog Talk Radio.
Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Wednesday, October 20. Is it 25th? Yes, it's 25th day of October. Today, we'll be chatting with our good friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. No, normally I write the agenda of our show, usually from 12 to 18 hours before, and I know pretty much what we're going to talk about. But this agenda, I've had to do a couple of times because there is so much going on right now in the country and in the world. And some of the stories, the Clintons are back. I'm not sure that this is what the book What Happened was supposed to be about, because they're talking about or answering questions about things that they probably did not want to talk about, uranium and the dossier and all that kind of stuff going around. The President Trump, for all the criticism, is moving ahead. I mean, you get a sense that things are moving in the right direction in Washington, at least in Congress, for quite some time. We just learned this morning that three aircraft carriers are now near North Korea. That's an incredible display of military power. The state of California, some information came out about the state of California, where 46% of the homes in California do not speak Spanish, or do not speak English. Maybe they speak Spanish, I don't know. It's an amazing statistic. I thought that this phone call controversy was going to be our top story of the day. We'll talk a little bit about that as well. And then another 46%, this time the American people, believe that the media makes up stuff about President Trump. So a lot to get into with our friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. Bill, beautiful day in Dallas. How is it in New York?
Beautiful day here in New York, and politically, it's getting cloudier and cloudier, isn't it? I mean, I think the Democratic Party must say, what did we get ourselves into with this Russia thing? It now turns out that it was the Democratic Party that was involved with Russia, and you know, throughout this whole thing, press corruption has played an enormous role. After the election, they said that Trump is not a legitimate president because he was colluding with the Russians. After all, the Russians are our enemy and our mortal enemy, and they're going to destroy us, and the world is going to come to an end. Isn't this the same party that laughed at Mitt Romney 4 years ago or 5 years ago now when he said that Russia was emerging as our chief enemy, and Barack Obama ridiculed him during one of the debates? It's the 1980s calling, the Democrats said. They want their foreign policy back. Now, all of a sudden, it was the greatest threat in human history. And without any proof, by the way, that there was any collusion. And apparently there still is no proof of any collusion. Mm-hmm. The proof that's coming out now is that it was the Clinton campaign and the Clinton crowd that was financing a lot of corrupt research on Donald Trump. And was getting enormous contributions to the Clinton Foundation while Hillary was Secretary of State from foreign countries. And basically, in effect, one could ask the question, were these bribes? Now, the question is, obviously, how big will this become? I mean, the mainstream media will do everything possible to suppress it, no matter what the facts are, except for some honest journalists who will not. It is commendable that the Washington Post brought this story out, and the New York Times, criticize and properly criticize. It will also depend on the actions of the Justice Department. And here we go back to the problem of President Trump and his inability to control himself. He attacked his new attorney general so viciously that what enthusiasm will Jeff Sessions have to carry this through? He's turning friends into enemies by the day. But this is a big story because apparently it goes into real collusion. between the Democrats and their law firms and their acolyte groups and Russian interests, and it could result even in prosecutions. But this is a really big deal.
Right. I agree with you that a lot of the media is going to probably try to not to get to this story, but we're living in a different world. We were talking off the air about how different baseball used to be. We'll talk about that a little bit later in the early 50s. But it's a whole different world with respect to the media, because the truth of the matter is I don't get any of my news anymore from the same places that I used to get it 30 years ago.
Right.
I don't see the New York Times. I see it off and on, but it's usually more the columns, not the paper itself. The Washington Post, the same thing. I'll read some of the columns. I don't really watch NBC, CBS, or ABC anymore for the nightly news. So the coverage of this story is coming from places that didn't even exist 20 years ago, the Fox News. But it's not just Fox News. You have a lot of websites like yours and lots of others. Bauerlein is doing a great job in this story as well. And these websites, Bill, are reaching a lot of people who matter, people who actually vote. I sometimes get the feeling that the people watching NBC Nightly News, there may be a lot of them, but I don't think they vote in the same numbers, let's say, the people who read Urgent Agenda or Powerline or something like that. And I think that the people are going to get to know this story quite well, at least the ones who vote and the ones who care. And I don't think they can hold it back anymore. If any of this is true, this is going to be a scandal that will not only involve the Clintons, but the Obama Justice Department. And I think that, Bill, I remember somebody joking, and I don't know if this is true or not, and it's kind of a nasty joke, but I remember, I think it was my number two son who said to me that Hillary Clinton didn't want to come out on election night because she was having a nervous breakdown. It was kind of a mean joke, I know. But when you look about, you think about it now, Bill, when she heard that she lost the election, she probably thought, oh my God, all this stuff that I thought I was going to be able to control, I cannot control anymore. And I'm sure that that's why they were looking for all kinds of ways to discredit Trump, Bill.
Well, absolutely. And the fact of the matter is also that the part of the story is that there were enormous contributions made to the Clinton campaign by people who were involved in a lot of this false research and a lot of these strange goings-on with Russia. There has always been a question about what the Clinton Foundation really is. As I understand it, they really don't contribute much of their money to genuine causes, that it seems to be more of an ATM. And I think this whole thing needs to be investigated. Whether it will be investigated, I don't know. I mean, Fox News is on it very strongly, obviously, but other people are not. And I think that this is really an opportunity for the Republican Party to shine in its own ability to strike back. But I don't know how much enthusiasm there is. I really don't. And we'll know, probably in 3 or 4 weeks where this goes. It's a huge scandal. I suspect that where there's smoke, there really is fire, and that we will find out some very bad things about the Clinton operation. But, you're going into a period now where the main story, at least in terms of CNN, seems to be the president's arguments with members of his own party. I never recall in political history where this was a big deal. I mean, parties have these arguments all the time.
Right.
Go back to 1948 when the southern states walked out of the Democratic Party. The whole region walked out, right out of the convention. Now, that's a real split. The fact that the president is having an argument with Jeff Flake is not world-shaking news. But here again, the problem is that the president himself compounds the problem by continuing the dispute. Nobody in the country cares about that. Now, his tax plan is in jeopardy because of this, because there are some people in the Republican Party in the Senate who may vote against it just to get back at Trump. I mean, they don't have any votes to spare. And I don't think they're going to bring in any Democrats, because any Democrat who dares to cooperate with them will be destroyed within his own party. So we may not get tax reform. We really may not get it. And you would have to blame on both the pettiness of some U.S. senators, but also on the president's continuing arguments with people. And we'll have to see. This is going to be a very critical period. He wants tax reform by Thanksgiving. That's ridiculous. They haven't even started writing the bill. Maybe they can get a general sketch out. Then he said, well, you know, by the end of the year. Well, but the end of the year is going to be 2.5 months from now. This is something the Republicans should have had ready, like a replacement for Obamacare, and they didn't. You know, the question has to be asked, is the Republican Party really a governing party? And I think the answer to that is up in the air. Now, the Democratic Party is definitely not a governing party, but you'd never know it reading the New York Times.
Right, and but again, I think going back to my point, I don't think that many people are reading the New York Times. I think that these newspapers are probably preaching to the choir. But I do, what you said about President Trump is something that concerned a lot of us during the primaries, and that is that he seems to, he doesn't seem to know when to stop fighting. Now, for example, Senator Flake of Arizona. Senator Flake has a lot of problems, and that's why he's not seeking re-election. He has a lot of problems in Arizona. He's probably he would probably be defeated in the primary. It's not all because of Trump. I mean, there's other things as well, immigration, other issues where he was clearly on the wrong side of the party in Arizona. And I think to get into a fight or make a victim out of Senator Flake is frankly a waste of time. I mean, Senator Flake has done enough to destroy himself. Crocker, Senator Crocker, the same way, Bill. And Senator Crocker was absolutely horrible with the Iran nuclear deal.
Exactly.
I mean, he was just absolutely awful. He should have fought the administration on that. So I think both of these men probably we'd be better off with two different Republicans, Bill. But unfortunately, Mr. Trump is making victims out of them right now.
Yes, that's right, and neither seat is secure. Arizona is increasingly becoming a Democratic state because of the immigration issue, and Tennessee is a state that can go either way. I mean, these are now swing states. There's no guarantee that the Republican candidates will win these, and the Republican Party can lose two seats, and then they're at 50. Now they may gain some seats somewhere else, but one of the first rules of sports is never take points off the board, and they're taking points off the board. Now, the House seems to be in pretty good shape, ironically, but it's the Senate where the real problem is. If Trump cannot present to the country a legislative victory, a major legislative victory, I don't know what happens after that. I don't know where his administration goes after that. Then he goes into the second 2 years of his administration with nothing. And if the Democrats take over Congress, he will definitely have nothing, and he will have to rule entirely on foreign policy and on executive agreements, which is pretty much what Obama did, and we criticized him for it, and probably so. The Democrats will not. This pipe dream of that the Democrats will cooperate. When is the Republican Party going to learn that the political left does not cooperate with anybody, no matter what you do? You know, even John McCain said, when he ran for president, he said, talking about the press, he said, I thought these people were my friends. When you are a conservative, you have no friends. The left will just turn against you in 2 seconds because that is the nature of the left. There's no spirit of compromise, and also there's no real patriotism. There really isn't. This is not the Democratic Party that I grew up in, the party of Roosevelt, Truman, and Kennedy. This is the party of George McGovern, Jimmy Carter, and Barack Obama. It's a very different organization.
No, you're exactly right. And, you know, you talk about arguments there. There were some pretty big arguments in the Democratic Party in 2008 between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. And there have been arguments before. I don't have a problem with arguments within the party because there's always good arguments in any organization. Where I think President Trump makes a mistake is that he often makes it very personal. And I think that, again, I understand the theory. I'm going to fight back. If they hit me, I'm going to hit back. But you don't necessarily have to reply with a nuclear bomb every time they criticize you, Bill. And that's a problem that I had with Trump in the primaries. And I thought he would outgrow that by now in the White House. He doesn't seem to be, Bill.
No, he doesn't seem to be. I'm afraid it's in his temperament. And, you know, we there may come a point where a lot of Republicans will say, look, Mr. President, maybe it's time to go. You know, it just which is what they did with Nixon. You know, people forget Nixon was never impeached. He was threatened with impeachment, and he would have been impeached, and it's quite possible he would have been removed because he wasn't popular even in his own party. And he kept on compounding his problems, which is exactly what Trump is doing. If Trump were impeached, I don't see what they could impeach him for. You know, I mean, it has to be a high crime or misdemeanor. He may be obnoxious, but being obnoxious is not a high crime. But the Democratic Party, if they get control of the House, they will impeach him, period. They will impeach him for breathing the wrong air. But then it goes to the Senate, and I'm not so sure the Republicans will stick with him.
Well, they got to get, 67 votes in the Senate?
It's a big deal. I mean, to get all those Republican votes, and on what basis would there be? I mean, there's no real basis to impeach him. We probably should have some kind of a mechanism. Well, we do, the 25th Amendment, where the cabinet can remove a president. But that's unlikely unless the indications were so strong that he was mentally ill or... And again, being obnoxious and being a bully, which he is both, those are not impeachable offenses. We've had other presidents who've been eccentrics. I mean, Truman was... he had to be kept under control to a certain degree. But in this particular case, I doubt very much if the cabinet would turn against him. I think that, and the vice president has to go along with it, by the way, and I doubt very much if Pence would do that, which would immediately make him a beneficiary of the action. But maybe we should have some mechanism similar to a European system where a vote of no confidence at a certain level could remove a president or at least serve as an official warning. To a president, the problem is with a president like this. What do you do? First of all, the man is getting things done. He really is. He is really trying. He's a serious president, and they don't give him credit for it. He's been very serious on North Korea. He's been very serious on Iran. He's been very serious on domestic policies. He's reversed a number of regulations that have made the economy better. The economy is getting better under his leadership. There are plenty of good things on his side if he would just not get in his own way.
Well, and I think to some extent, Bill, that's what happened with the call to that young widow. I mean, I'm not defending by any means the congresswoman who I think was clearly playing politics with this.
Disgraceful.
But I am, you know, I'm thinking about President Trump could have handled this in such a different way. Even today, if he were to call the young widow and say, look, I'm very sorry if you misunderstood what I said, and here's what I meant to say. You know, if he had done that, for example, if he would do something like that, I think that would end a lot of this. But it seems like he has a temperament where he has to have the last word. And I understand, I mean, I get what he's trying to do. He remembered what happened to President Bush. Bush was the other extreme. Where he never fought back. So he remembers that, and I give him a little bit of credit for fighting back. But sometimes he overdoes it, I think, and when he overdoes it, then I think he comes out looking bad, though.
You know, it's the old idea that, you know, never complain, never explain. But sometimes you do have to explain. In the case of the widow, this was an absolutely disgraceful hit job. It's the old story. Victims have responsibilities. We feel for her. She has two children. She has another one on the way. And the story came out that his phone call was offensive. Who did it come out from? Not her, from this evil congresswoman who has a terrible record. She also tried to politicize Trayvon Martin. I mean, she was the one who did it. She's an absolute hack partisan. He probably got on the phone and was entirely appropriate, because we have other phone calls that have actually been taped. He was just fine. I mean, not as eloquent as perhaps Obama would be, or as gracious as Reagan would be, who could do these things so well, but saying basically the right things. I mean, does anyone really believe he made the call to be unsympathetic? He made the call to be sympathetic. He probably said something to the effect that, you know, your husband knew what he was getting into, and what he meant by that was he did it anyway. He did it for his country. But he is not a particularly articulate man, Trump, and an articulate man would know how to say that in such a way as to make it what he really meant, and that is that the man was a hero. The widow said he didn't even know my husband's name. It's on a card right in front of him. When the president makes a call like that, there's a card with the names of the children and everything like that. It is possible he stumbled on the fact that the man had an unusual first name, and that is it wasn't David, it was La David. And maybe he saw it and for a minute thought maybe it was a typographical error. But I don't know who the widow is. It's a terrible thing to say, but you wonder, she's a Gold Star widow, you must feel sympathetic for her loss. At the same time, for all we know, she could be a political activist as well. I mean, we don't know. And no, there was no reporting on it. I mean, CNN was obnoxious. Don Lemon, just absolutely obnoxious, reading the worst possible things into it. And when the White House responded, they didn't respond in a particularly articulate way. They should have said the president made a perfectly appropriate call. General Kelly was in the room. It's sad that the widow interpreted it or misinterpreted it, but the president sadly has to make these calls, and we've never had a complaint. And left it at that, but he kept on going day after day every time this congresswoman made a remark. Now, I put a great deal of blame on her, who she is a hack, and I put a great deal of blame on CNN and some of the other news organizations that milked it. But, from what I can see, he didn't do anything wrong.
Well, Bill, the only thing he may have done wrong is not wrong in the phone call, but he got a question, and this is something I'm still surprised. He has been president now for 9 months. If he doesn't understand that they're out to get him, then he's very naive. Okay?
That's right.
They're out to get him. Every question at these press conferences, he has to understand that every some of these questions are traps. So he gets a question about, I think, about calling widows and mothers or whatever of these soldiers. And then he gets into a discussion as to who calls more widows, he or Obama.
Yeah.
And to me, that's a stupid discussion.
Of course,
that's an idiotic discussion. He shouldn't even touch that.
Of course. He just cannot control himself. Right. And this could be a fatal flaw. I mean, it really can be a fatal flaw. You know, I grew up in the Nixon era. Nixon was called, as you know, Tricky Dick. And he was called Tricky Dick because that's what he was. But Nixon was also a highly qualified man. I mean, I hate to say it about a man who really was obnoxious. But he was a very highly qualified president, very knowledgeable and very serious. But in 1960, when he ran for president the first time, one of my mentors, Paul Douglas, who was a Democratic senator, but a very fair-minded man, said the problem with Nixon is he's the kind of man who put his opponents in jail. He had a character flaw, and a character flaw can be a small one or a big one. And in Nixon's case, it was a big one. This is a man who on two separate occasions, Richard Nixon, put his country before himself in the 1960 election, which he could have easily contested. There was plenty to contest, but he said, no, I don't want to put the country through this. And then when he resigned, he could have fought it all the way through to impeachment, and he might have survived in the Senate. But he said that this is best. He on many occasions, despite his flaws, put the country first. And ironically, his ego was not very great for a man in his position. And he was never given any credit for it because, once again, the naive Republican Party, thinking the Democratic press will give you credit for anything, they will not. But he had that side to him that came out during Watergate. All he had to do in Watergate was walk out the day after the story broke and say, this happened on my watch. I take responsibility. These are the things we are doing to make sure this never happens again, but I certainly don't approve of it. And that would have been the end of it. He didn't understand how the system worked. The story was pushed by Ben Bradley of the Washington Post, who was a personal friend of Jack Kennedy, who had been a personal friend of Jack Kennedy. In fact, in the movie, All the President's Men, you see the picture of Kennedy right behind Bradley.
Right.
And he didn't realize this was all about politics, that they were out to get him, and he put himself in the position where he got gotten.
And that's how I feel about Trump as well, because He has to know by now. We're in the ninth month of his presidency, as I said a minute ago. He has to know by now that they're out to get him. That I would say a lot of these questions are traps. I mean, what a coincidence. He gets a question about calling widows, and then about the same time he's talking to a widow. I don't know. Maybe I'm too cynical, but maybe there's a connection there. And it seems to me that if he had answered the question about the widows by saying, look, every president cares about these people who serve, and I'm not going to get into that next question. If he had done that, he could have avoided a lot of this. But I sometimes get the feeling. Now, one thing about Nixon, we'll take a break, but I just want to say a quick thing about Nixon. I've read a lot about Nixon. Nixon was very quick on his feet, and I don't think Trump is. That's the difference. Nixon was very quick on his feet. He could really spot a question or answer it correctly. I know he had character flaws. I agree with you on that. But he was very quick on his feet. I don't think Trump is. I think Trump is very smart. Obviously, he's doing a lot of things. I agree with you. But I think he very often goes for the bait. And there's a lot of people out there putting the bait in front of him, Bill.
That's right. He is exactly – it's exactly as you described it. He doesn't understand they're out to get him. You know, there are people – there are a lot of people who think that way. It's amazing, and they may be the most intelligent people in other respects, but they don't understand their enemy. You know, the old cliche about know your enemy. I mean, I remember the story in World War II. It's a terrible, terrible story, a poignant story, about how German Jews would march into the concentration camps carrying their World War I medals, thinking that was going to protect them. They just had no concept of who they were dealing with, and obviously it didn't protect them. And there are people like Trump who really believe, and like Nixon, that if I put a good argument out there, they'll be convinced. They're not going to be convinced because they are programmed not to give him one inch of anything. These are the American press today is controlled by an element that believes that they are superior people, that democracy exists only when they win, and if they lose, it must be because of some ulterior force. And that's not true. There was, I mean, you know, we all know why Hillary Clinton lost, and she's proving it once again by this magical mystery tour of hers in which every day there's another conspiracy theory.
Right. No, you're exactly right. But Trump has to learn, it because if he doesn't, he's going to have a lot worse days than he's had last week. And the good things are never going to get out, unfortunately, about his presidency. We're going to take a little break. We'll be back with Bill right after this. Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, and we're talking with our good friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. Bill, I want to take a little off, just get off the topic for a quick second and remember a fellow by the name of Bobby Thompson, who was born on this day in 1923. And if anybody had said to you that the biggest home run in Major League history would be hit by a fellow born in Scotland, that would be a big story in itself, Bill.
Oh, yes. Well, you know, Bobby Thompson is the man who, number 23 on the New York Giants baseball
third
team.
Third baseman.
And
third baseman.
Yes, 1951, hit what was known as the shot heard around the world, which, as we said before we went on the air and we talked about this a little bit, is hilarious because the world in those days in baseball – began in Boston and ended in St. Louis.
That's right.
I mean,
that's
you know. Right. So, but I remember we were in class. I was in junior high school, and when a big baseball event occurred that was of interest to New Yorkers, they would literally suspend the classes, and you would listen on the PA system. People were amazed to hear that they actually did that in those days. But this was a pennant game between the Brooklyn Dodgers, the greatest ball team in all of human history, and the New York Giants, who played across town somewhere in a field I don't remember. And for us Dodger fans, of course, this was you know, a heavenly situation, and it was the deciding game of the pennant race, and it was a playoff, and Bobby Thompson hit the home run that won the pennant for the New York Giants. And I had Jim the next period. First of all, nobody could believe it. I mean, we were stunned. It was really almost a medical problem that this could happen. But then we had Coach Deming, who got up and he walked back and forth like a philosopher, saying, "Well, some people will call this luck. Other people will call this skill." And I was sitting there thinking, I don't care what you call it. We lost. You know, what do you call anything you like? But this became really the most famous play, I think, in baseball history.
It is. It is, of course, for a generation, obviously. Things have changed. There may be others in a later generation. Clearly, for your generation, it was the greatest moment in history. But I always find it amusing. And we were talking about this off the air, but I've thought about this many times before, that the shot heard around the world was a baseball game between two teams that were 7 miles apart, Ebbets Field and Polo Grounds.
The Polo Grounds.
That was the name of the park, yeah.
Yes.
And it was hit in the Polo Grounds.
At least the name of the – go ahead.
Yeah,
go
I was
going to
say, Bill, that's the only place – the only baseball field, well, that ball would have been a home run because there was a short fence in left field. So.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Ebbets Field was the smallest field in the major leagues. And when they had Dodger-Yankee World Series, and there were a number of them, the Yankees, of course, their home field was Yankee Stadium, which was the largest stadium in the major league. So you went from the largest stadium to the smallest stadium in one day. And it's one of the things that made baseball so fascinating, because the players had to judge each field. I remember going to being a Dodger fan, I mean, setting foot in Yankee Stadium was like setting foot in enemy country. I mean, you didn't want to go. You needed a passport. They checked you at the gate. But we went there once because the neighbor said, Joe DiMaggio was playing one of his last games. Would you like to go? And I said, sure. And I had never seen Joe DiMaggio play live. And you look out in center field, and there was this little spot on the field, literally a spot, and it was Joe DiMaggio. At Ebbets Field, you could hand the center fielder a Coke. I mean, the field was that small. It's one of the things that made baseball interesting. Even the ballparks had real names like Yankee Stadium or Ebbets Field, who was named for Charlie Ebbets. Look at it today. I mean, there's which field was it where the Astros won their
pennant?
I think it's called Minute Maid Stadium.
Right, Minute Maid Park.
My God, how humiliating. I mean, it's terrible.
That's better
they name a field after orange juice? I mean,
well, but that's better than the previous name. The previous name was Enron Field. Of course,
oh,
they
God,
changed
yes.
that after the scandal.
Yes, yes. But I mean,
but you're right. I think Yankee Stadium is the only one left that actually has the name of the team. Maybe Dodger Stadium. I don't know. I don't know about Dodger Stadium in L.A., but
I think it is Dodger Stadium. But those are, I think, the only ones
be,
left.
Yeah.
I mean, the Mets play in, I think it's a Citi Field,
City
named
Park,
for a bank.
Right.
How disgraceful! then there are these other places named for plastic toy companies or diaper.
Right.
Can you imagine? Can you remember? Imagine Pampers Field, named for a diaper. I mean, that'll be next.
Well, the Rangers here play in a field named after an insurance company. Of course, what they do is, and this just shows you how the game has changed economically, Bill. What they do is they get some company to pay a substantial amount of money to be the sponsor of the field.
Yes, that's right.
And that's how they get the money. I think in the case of the Yankees, they figure that their name is big enough. I don't know why they haven't changed their name, because everybody else seems to be doing it. But it just shows you the different times. But one more baseball note before we get back to the serious stuff. The next generation of the Dodgers is now playing in L.A., and they're in the World Series, and they won last night. So you may recognize them. They have the same uniform, except for the cap, when they played in Brooklyn, Bill.
That's right. I don't recognize that cap. I think that, yes, they have the nerve to continue even the same word Dodgers across their chest. I think it should have been banned by, I don't think they should be allowed into New York. It was a disgraceful year, 1957. I remember it. I mean, Pete Hamill, the great journalist, said, in Brooklyn, there were three villains, Adolf Hitler, Joseph Stalin, and Walter O'Malley. Walter O'Malley was the owner of the Dodgers, and he is the one who moved the Dodgers to Los Angeles. Now, in fairness, one of the reasons for that move was the absolute bumbling of New York City. I mean, they
right.
didn't realize how important this was. They should have just given them a stadium. But we had mm-hmm. Mayor Wagner, whose main contribution to the city was that he was the son of a very distinguished senator, and he kind of slept his way through his mayoralty. And you had some other people in the city government who just did not understand what was happening. And so we lost both the Dodgers and the Giants.
Right. No, that was an incredible moment for baseball. And, of course, the Dodgers moving to L.A., was had to be one of the big ones. Well, let's get back to President Trump. In many ways, Bill, I was going to say right before the break that in many ways he is getting things done. You mentioned it yourself, and you wonder, you think of how much more things he could do if he could just maybe listen to Chief of Staff Kelly a little bit more. Maybe if Chief of Staff Kelly could speak on behalf of the president, he would have less problems. I like Chief of Staff Kelly. I really like.
Well, they tried.
He seems
the press tried to ruin him.
The right
too.
Temperament for the job.
Yes, but the press immediately went after Kelly, basically calling him a racist. I mean, it was unbelievable. Some of them on MSNBC and Don Lemon again. He's insensitive. He grew up in a segregated neighborhood in Boston. What neighborhood wasn't segregated when he grew up? Just awful. I mean, the viciousness of the left, and they do absolutely nothing intelligent to fight it in the White House. They play right into their hands.
Right.
But yes, John Kelly has a wonderful demeanor and a wonderful temperament. He himself, of course, is a Gold Star father and understands these things. But if the key point right now is for the president to have some legislative victories. He is going to Asia next, and he has prepared that trip very well. He has engaged in a major show of force before the North Koreans. Three aircraft carrier groups are in the area, which is unusual. He is doing it exactly right. He is going for diplomatic purposes, but he has the power of the United States behind him. If he could do things that way more often, he'd be better off. But I just
right.
have a feeling that his enemies in the party are going to knife him. And that would be sad. It would be sad for the country, most of all, because we need
right.
this tax relief and we need a new tax system. But I mean, again, who did he get into a fight with earlier in the year? Mitch McConnell. I mean,
right.
he is the man he needs most of all. And I think it is the mentality of the New York real estate industry that he comes from, which is a very tough, thuggish industry where you just engage in armed combat every day. And I just don't think he was able to make the transition.
Well, and again, I see good and bad qualities in that personality. The good is that I think North Korea takes him very seriously.
I think they do.
Right.
Yeah,
I think China takes. So when he puts three aircraft carrier groups near North Korea, I think everybody in that region realizes that they could go to war. They could go to work at any moment. So I think in that respect, his personality works for the United States. I also think they take him seriously in Cuba, for example. I think they
yeah.
take him seriously in Venezuela. They take him seriously in other places. I think ISIS takes him seriously. So there's a good side to that quality. The only thing different, I suppose, from being a real estate tycoon is that in politics, in real estate, I guess everybody's your enemy because you're competing with everybody. Here, you're supposed to take care of your friends. And, you know, as to me, Mitch McConnell is doing the best he can, given the fact that he's got 52 votes and
That's
the fact
right.
that these senators represent different districts and different states. So I wish he would pick his fights, Bill. I guess that's my recommendation
right.
to the president. Pick your fights.
Yes. And he should mostly pick fights with his enemies, not with his friends.
Right. That's right. Pick fights with Democrats who don't vote with you. But hopefully he will outgrow that. But right now, it's a real problem for him. Now, we're talking about the media a minute ago, and I wanted to bring up a poll that came out this week that President Carter, the same week that President Carter said that Mr. Trump is getting a bad press or worse treatment than
the worst
his predecessor. I thought that was an interesting comment coming from President Carter. But but anyway, 46% Bill in a brand new poll say that that the media makes up stuff about President Trump. I thought that was amazing, Bill. That poll.
It was an amazing poll, and I think we're getting a lot of polls now. A lot of polls now that seem to be what I call tentative polls. They're polls for this week, and then next week the numbers are different. Polls right now will have very little to do with the election next year. They're just basically temporary guides to where public opinion is. And what's remarkable is that Trump's numbers don't change very much. They kind of stay at the same level, and that level is not a terrible level. I just looked up as we were speaking. Rasmussen has him today at 42%. He has been in that territory for a long, long time in the Rasmussen poll and in some of the other polls lower. But it's interesting that if you go back and look at the Obama administration, Obama was in the low 40s for most of his presidency. It's very common for presidents to be at that level. But once a campaign begins, the numbers start to shift as people pay more attention. So, you know, I don't know what these polls say. I think each side has its base that is immovable. Mm-hmm. I think that if Trump gets things done, he can go to the people, and we would hope that they would once again overlook his negative side, which
right.
is exactly what happened last year. If he gets nothing done, he has nothing to argue with. His main argument was, I'm a man of results. I know the art of the deal. I wrote a book called The Art of the Deal. Well, so far he's not shown a great ability at making deals. He really hasn't.
Right.
Because this is Washington. Each person has his own power center, which is not necessarily true in the real estate industry when you're crushing tenants. You know, I mean, these are guys
right.
who have their own power centers in their own states, and he's got to come through with something big. That now is the central feature of the administration.
Right. No, I agree with you, and he doesn't have a lot. He has, you know, every day that goes by, he's been president for 9 months, so he, you know, almost 25% of his first term is consumed, and the closer you get to 2018, the more political it gets. I mean, he's got to get a lot of things done by next spring. Now, in all fairness to President Trump, President Obama didn't get Obamacare until April 2010, so he does have time to get some things done, but I think this 46% poll, Bill, says to me a lot more about the media. And if I was the editor of a newspaper, I would call my people in and I would say, folks, look at this poll. Half of the people out there think we're making things up about the president. That's not very good for our profession, Bill.
No, but they don't. The arrogance of the press is beyond belief. I mean, I was in the press and I saw it every day. I mean, they really believe they walk on water. We are the protectors of the country. We are your eyes and ears. I've heard that many times. We are the eyes and ears of the public. No, they're not. They're the eyes and ears of themselves and of nobody else. But they really do believe that they are playing a great role here. If you talk to people in journalism, they believe they're heroes right now. We are holding
right.
the fort for democracy against this evil man. In fact, they aren't. And my question to them always is, if you're so important in holding the administration accountable, why didn't you perform the same function during the Obama administration?
Right.
Where
right.
they gave him a pass on almost anything. I think Obama could shoot a dog dead in front of the American people, and they'd say, well, the dog was attacking him. You know, the dog was white, had white hair, the dog was a racist. And that's what it would be. But the press has a very poor rating. I think one of the things that has contributed to that is the fact that today people have so many other sources, as you pointed out before. The internet has, in a way, saved the idea of journalism, because
mm-hmm.
now there are independent journalists who can report the news and get an audience. And I'm,
right.
you know, I'm one of them. The press has never really adapted to that. I think
right.
that also the bias is so blatant that they can't get around it.
Right, and I was just thinking about that, Bill, because, you know, this week it came out that Rachel Maddow, or Maddow, whatever her name is, has the number one show on cable for this week, and she's been back and forth with Hannity. But I was thinking about the political impact of that. It's absolutely zero, and here's my point. She's not creating any new voters for the Democrat Party. Everybody who watches her show is either an anti-Trump crazy, a nut, someone who wants to sit there every night and just feed their fancy hatred of Trump. She's not actually helping the Democrat Party win one single vote. So what difference does it make that she's getting 3 million people? Don Lemon the same way. I don't think these people are making the party bigger. So in a sense, they're just talking to themselves, Bill.
Well, to a degree, that is true, and that has been noted by press critics and press observers, that people tend to watch the network that they agree with. So you're absolutely right on that. I think it is quite amazing, by the way, that Rachel Maddow has become so popular. She is probably the most tolerable of the people at MSNBC, and maybe it's because of that she's been able to break through their very low numbers. And also, remember that Fox has had a lot of problems in the last year, a lot. And still, they're way up there in the ratings. What's interesting, though, is that most people, and I don't think this is widely realized, most people still watch the three networks. I haven't watched a network news program all the way through in years. It must be 20 years. I find those programs to be soft, to be more feature-oriented than hard news. I find them very biased, reflecting the bias of mainstream journalism toward the Democratic Party. And once you get used to the 24-hour news cycle on the cable systems, it's hard to get away from them.
Right. No, I agree with you. Let me jump to another story that I think has profound consequences, Bill, or could have profound consequences, and that's a story out of California that 46% of the homes out there do not speak English. Now, in the interest of full disclosure, I grew up in a home in the United States where we spoke Spanish. I still speak Spanish to my mom, to my wife, to my kids some of the time, to my brother and my sister. So, you know, I grew up that way, but we always understood, Bill, that outside the door we had to learn English, and my parents made it very clear to us that in order to succeed you had to speak English. And that's what worries me about California, if those parents out there have the same attitude as my parents, Bill.
Well, that's the $64,000 question, isn't it? What attitudes exist within the homes? You know, Barbara Bush, who is usually not quoted, Bush 41's wife, said at a speech once, what counts in this country is not what happens in the White House, but what happens in your house. And I think she's right. I don't know that much about the parenting of people in California, about what parenting is like. I know that throughout the country it seems to be an art that is fading away. But the parents can speak the foreign language. As you said, it was a very common characteristic, a common characteristic of immigrant communities generally. But good parents always stress to their children they had to learn English. I don't know if that's being done anymore. I assume it is, by the way. I assume it is. Because the kids are learning English. I mean, there are very few kids who go on to high school, for example, who are not functional in English. They generally are. They may not be experts in the language, and they may not speak it and read it with the facility of a native-born citizen. But I do think that idea is getting through. However, mm-hmm. I think that the idea of a common language is critically important to teach to kids, not only so they will understand the language, but they will understand why we have a common language, so people can communicate with each other. Because if a kid tries to get a job, let's say a Hispanic child tries to get a job in a company after school and is not functional in English, he or she will not get that job. And that is the important thing to teach. That's the
right. And but of course, one of the and again, I think we're in the middle of the experiment, so we don't know how it's going to turn out, because in some Hispanic communities, you can actually get a job without speaking English. I know here in Dallas, for example, there's a lot of places in the Hispanic side of town, well, you can get a job and not speak English. So I don't know if that was the case 20 or 30 years ago. I have a very good friend here at church who was born in Brooklyn like you were, and he was born in an Italian family in the 1930s, and he said that he spoke Italian at home for 6 or 7 years. But once he got to school, he was there next to a bunch of other kids from different ethnic groups, but they all had to learn English. I mean, it was demanded by the school. Now we have bilingual education. Now we have other options for people who don't speak English. I'm just beginning to wonder. It's an experiment, and we won't know the results for a while. But if these kids are not being impressed upon these kids to speak English, California is going to have some very serious problems down the road, Bill.
Oh, well, California, yes, and you've made the point before that California has a lot of problems already. I mean, they have lost all of their big industry. They do have Silicon Valley, but the big aircraft companies are gone. The state is nowhere near as educated as it should be. The California school system is not as strong as it used to be. That may not be entirely the fault of the Democratic Party, but I think they are largely at fault. And they have a state government, a state legislature that is run by crazy people. I mean, apparently now in California, you can go to prison. If you're a state official, you can go to prison if you don't call people by their designated gender. I mean, that's crazy stuff. And it's become the state that is race, gender, and ethnicity, and that's about all. And
that's it.
That's not what California was at one time. California really was, at one time, in a way, the promised land. When I was younger, it was a beautiful state. When Reagan was governor, it was a balanced state politically. It had thoughtful people from across the spectrum. Now it's a state plagued with problems, plagued with infrastructure problems, and with this obsession with identity. And you kind of wonder now, Barbara Boxer, who was a whack job herself, was just replaced by Kamala Harris, who wants immediately to run for president. the other senator, Dianne Feinstein, may not survive a primary. I mean, she may be replaced by a guy far to her left. The governor, ironically, Jerry Brown, who used to be, Reagan used to call him Governor Moonbeam. He held the same post back in the 1970s. He was governor in the 1970s. I have to say that for a guy of his liberal persuasion, he's acted relatively rationally. He has not gone off the deep end the way some of them have. I think he was very courageous a few days ago in vetoing a bill that would have frozen in place the Obama administration's Title IX requirements for colleges and universities.
Yes.
And that was a bad bill because those are bad requirements. And he vetoed it, and he said there are enough law professors and legal experts who have pointed out the deficiencies here, and I cannot go along with it. A good move and a very heroic move on his part.
I think so. He also may be running for president, so we may be hearing his name in a couple of years as well, Bill. I have that feeling that once he gets I think his term ends in 18. I wouldn't be surprised if he runs for president after that. Well, we don't have a whole week to look forward to as we normally do on Sunday nights, but what are some of the things you keep an eye on the next few days?
Well, the Democratic Party scandal involving Russia. I mean, this is too juicy to avoid. And let's see how it develops and how the Republican Party handles it and whether Trump can get his administration to handle it in an appropriately beneficial way. That's one thing. And the development of the tax bill. This is really an important story. I mean, whether or not the Republicans can get to work night and day and come out with a great tax bill and then pass it. And then you're going to see a dramatic last days on this when the question is, how will these senators that Trump went after vote on the tax bill? And I think some of them will be of two minds. They may say, I want to really destroy Trump. Others might say, if I do it, I'm going to look awfully small. So let's see if he can get – he's got to get Collins. He's got to get Murkowski. He's got to get Flake. He's got to get Corker. He's got to get McCain. Those are the
right.
He apparently has Rand Paul on board. But
right.
those are the senators who caused him a problem, and let's see. And since he's been feuding with all the others, let's see what actually can be done.
Well, he may get Senator Manchin, who just made a profound statement that he doesn't really want Hillary Clinton working in his reelection. You know, it's funny, that didn't get a lot of coverage, but that's pretty
yes.
important for a senator
that's
like
right.
that to say, no thanks. I don't need you in West Virginia, and she's not very popular anyways in West Virginia. Well, Bill, I hope the Dodgers don't win. I like to see Houston win, but maybe by the next time we chat, there will be a World Series champ because they could sweep all four games. The Dodgers look awfully good.
They do, and it's a sad day for us. Well, we will here in New York at least vicariously say, you're not as good as the old guys, but at least you're pretty good.
You're pretty good. You have the right uniforms.
Yeah. Right uniforms, right, right.
You got the right uniforms. It's amazing. They are, in fact, the same uniforms the Brooklyn Dodgers had.
Exactly.
They have not changed one bit. Now, that's a good thing. I like tradition myself, so that's a
yep,
good thing. Bill, have a great day, and thank you so much for giving us your time.
Oh, it's always a pleasure. We'll talk on Sunday.
That's right. We'll talk the next time. Thank you so
right.
much, Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. I think it will not be on Sunday, but we'll talk to Bill about that later. All right, everybody, have a great week. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.